Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Julie Guy from Eastern Passage, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So that was Julie, and Julie is backer number one. She was the first person to back us in the last 2 years of our Kickstarter here on the Tennis Podcast. Every year when we try to fund the following year's 130-odd episodes of the show, and Julie is there with us. So thank you, Julie. Catherine Whittaker's here. Catherine's just been presenting live TV for the past 12 hours. And it was a little bit different, Catherine, I think, covering the ATP finals on day one with the same players in the first match as in the last match a year ago, but it was a bit different.
Yes, it's as if the scriptwriters were trying to emphasise the contrast. And I think Stefanos Tsitsipas summed it up, didn't he? He was asked after his three-set defeat to Dominic Thiem, the first time a defending champion at the ATP Finals in London has lost their first match defending the title. He was asked after the match in press, quite a terse press conference by all accounts. I've only read the transcript, I didn't see it live, but I don't think he was in the best of moods. He was asked what was the difference between today and the last match he played against Dominic, which was here last year, and he said, people. And that was kind of everything summed up by Stefanos Tsitsipas.
It is very well summed up. Hello, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, fine, thank you. Yes, I think he really did hit the nail on the head there. Because when I was watching that match, I was finding it difficult to reconcile what I was seeing in front of me, which was really good tennis, and how I was feeling, which was a little bit flat, a little bit of melancholy. And I think it was just all there, as you said, because it was such a direct, perfect contrast to the last match we saw at London. It just really did emphasise and highlight everything that we're missing this season, this year. And I think especially for Tsitsipas, he's the kind of guy, I think, who will build up a connection with a place. And I think even before this tournament, he described the ATP Finals as a meeting spot where people gather to celebrate their success of the year. He was already talking in very glowing terms about it. And I think he's defended his title before in Marseille and talked about having affection with certain tournaments. And I just think he was kind of shocked and surprised by how different it was, how different it felt without the fans. And yeah, it was a terse press conference and his body language was quite dejected in it. He was really quite down about the whole thing, really, even though I actually don't think he played that badly. I thought he played okay, but just his overall experience was disappointing for him.
Must bring it home, must feel a bit eerie for those two players. Having stepped off that court a year ago, because as I seem to recall, it was one of the great atmospheres that place has ever known. People were so into that match, and it was very split, wasn't it? The crowd support between the two, and there were a lot of local or partisan fans, Greek fans in the crowd, chanting the name of Tsitsipas on that day. And, you know, he's won it in such dramatic style. And then, yeah, you come out, and they did their best with the show. We know how it came across on TV. I'm sure many of our listeners would have watched on TV. What did it look like and feel like to be in the stadium, Catherine?
Well, I'm very, very aware that I am having an extremely biased experience, and my perspective on it is biased because for me, as much as I am missing the things that everybody watching at home is missing, I'm also getting something particularly special, which is getting to watch live tennis in the flesh. I realize the privilege of what I'm about to say, but I haven't gone, nine months without watching live professional tennis in my career. I probably didn't even, you know, I was going as a fan a couple of times a year before I worked in the sport. You know, it's a long, long time since I've had a drought like that. So just seeing live tennis is food for the soul for me. And I'm very, very conscious that other people aren't getting that. I do think trying to eliminate that very personal factor, I do think lack of crowds is exacerbated at indoor events. I am reaching that conclusion more and more solidly. And I just don't think there's really any way around that. I think it's sort of just incubating and amplifying the negative impact of it. It is what it is. I think they've done what they can. Okay, they've not done things like the US Open did with the fan wall and everything. But I think on reflection, given how much that potentially cost, did it add enough to make it worthwhile? I don't know. I think they've done pretty much everything they can. I think it looks visually fantastic. I mean, as it usually does, beautifully illuminated. It looks like that sort of blue floating stage, doesn't it? The visual impact of it all is incredible. And I love those spotlights. I said this a couple of nights ago. I love those spotlights they've put on the lower tier to create a sort of polka dot effect. And of course, they do have the ability to black out a lot of the seating so that you're not seeing big swathes of empty seats. I think the visual effect of it is brilliant. And they still, it's funny, the playlist that the DJ is playing, it's mostly the same playlist as last year, except they've removed all the upbeat bangers. I don't know if there's been some kind of board meeting where they've gone through last year's set list and they've gone, yeah, that's, you know, that's appropriately melancholy. No, Dance Monkey. No, gotta go. Gotta go.
They also removed the heartbeat sound as well. Or
no, the heartbeat's there.
Is that there? Because I couldn't really pick that up.
The heartbeat is there.
But yep. They have removed David Bowie Heroes.
They have.
As the victory song.
They now have two victory songs, from what I can tell.
One of them is Sia, Unstoppable.
One of them is Sia, Unstoppable, which is one of my Get Yourself Fired Up songs. I've listened to that in the back of a cab a few times. And the other one is Whatever It Takes by Imagine Dragons.
Mm. I have been waiting for them to find a new song, you know, other than Heroes. But, you know, they've been playing that for 10, 11 years in a row. But strangely, today I did feel like, again, it was just adding to the sense that I was missing something. And
yeah, yeah. Bring me my David Bowie comfort blanket.
Mm, exactly.
Matt Roberts disses David Bowie's
song collection. Last year, Matt, there was some Bruce Springsteen on the set list. I heard Downbound Train at least three times a day. I've not heard it yet. And I think that is sufficiently downbeat to make the 2020 playlist.
That's about
playlist.
As downbeat as it gets, yeah.
Yeah. So I'd be surprised if that's gone the same way as Dance Monkey, personally. But we shall see.
So the first singles match of the day was Stefanos Tsitsipas against Dominic Thiem. And it was close. It's stylistically just the most beautiful match to watch on paper, isn't it? And they've shared victories. I think it's now 5-3, is it? I think in Thiem's mm-hmm. favour, the head-to-head between the two of them. They came in at 4-3. I was curious to look at when their last meeting was, and I didn't realise it was that one a year ago. So which I find a shame, really. And obviously, a 6 month pandemic will contribute towards that. But that is a rivalry that I really want to see just develop and continue, because I love to watch them play against each other, because although they both have a single-handed backhand and they both try to do things differently and their weapons are a little different. Team is a point ender with a single stroke, and Tsitsipas has got that cover on the ball with that little bit of extra topspin, hasn't he, that just dips at the last second, which I've always loved to watch that as well. So just the rally construction between the two I always find fascinating. But, and I was sort of half watching the first set whilst making the kids their lunch and that sort of thing. And then suddenly I realised that Tsitsipas is, I think, 4-1 up in the tiebreak, and really looks in charge. And from there, you're thinking, he's going to win this tiebreak. And clearly, from that press conference, so did he. Because he describes the point, I think it was at 5-3 in the tiebreak, where he's attacked and he's underneath a lob and he doesn't win the point. And that, I would imagine that as we come to you right now at 11 o'clock at night on Sunday in the UK, I think Stefanos Tsitsipas is either lying in bed right now looking up at the ceiling thinking about that point, or he's just on his third whiskey, one of the two, maybe both. But that's going to stay with him, because that ball floated over his head, didn't it? And he ran back, tried to play it over his shoulder, ended up lobbing it up, and Tsitsipas won the point, and team won the point rather, and team took over.
I suspect it's probably the former. I think some whiskey would probably help him. Although there was that very strange lockdown monologue video where with the corona bottles in the foreground.
Oh God, yeah. That feels like a long time ago.
Sorry to remind you all of that, but that was peak Tsitsipas weird, wasn't it? So maybe alcohol isn't the best idea. Yeah, I feel like he's probably writing some sort of Sylvia Plath style poetry about that point in the tiebreak.
Yeah, he described it as one of the silliest things that's ever happened to me.
Yeah, be more silly.
I mean, this
Stefanos,
is a guy who had
you're
his
a young man.
Shoes laced by Leander Paes during a match. He's lost his perspective on silly.
then he won the second set and made it really competitive. And actually, one of the most, I'm not that into statistical analysis of matches, really going in depth personally. That's not something that I really go for. But there was a statistic shown on the Prime coverage that you were presenting, Catherine, I think in just at the start of the third set, showing the difference in the amount that Dominic Thiem was slicing his backhand in the second set versus the first set. And in the first set, he'd been hitting it much more firmly and not slicing. And the second set, he'd hit loads of slices and it really just wasn't working for him. And then at the third set, Matt, early on, I noted a stat that you put out about the sheer number of winners that Thiem suddenly started striking. What was happening? Because I didn't see the third set, much of the third set.
Yeah, I think he just ramped up his aggression and his intensity in that third set. And I think in the end, he hit close to 20 winners in that deciding set and just took charge and took control of it. And I think that's really interesting to see Thiem play that way. It kind of backed up what he was saying at the start of this tournament, which is that he feels just as comfortable now on a hard court as he does on a clay court. And I think because of the results Thiem's had, we can take that a little bit for granted. You know, he's come in as a US Open champion, Australian Open finalist now. It's kind of natural that he says that. But if you go back a few years, Thiem saying that really would have seemed kind of extraordinary. There has been this incredible development and it's been quite gradual, but I think it's really been, you can trace it through his performances at the ATP finals in a way. You know, his first few years here, he won one match in the group, but didn't make it out of the group, never really threatened, never really felt like a contender. But then last year he found this comfort zone, I think, on a hard court that he's carried into this year. And that means he can dictate the play without having to sustain this really massive peak level. He's got a level now where he's comfortable at, and it's an aggressive level. And he found that in the third set. And when he plays like that, he's really a match for anyone in the world. And he was too good for Tsitsipas in that third set, coupled with some really excellent serving. I think there was one game where Tsitsipas did threaten to break, and every time he did, team found a first serve in the corner. I was really impressed, and also encouraged by the fact that his foot injury, which we were a little bit concerned about, just didn't seem to be a factor at all. He seemed completely fine and recovered.
He went quite deep, Catherine, team, after he won that match in the end. He went quite deep on the weariness of bubble life.
Bubble fatigue.
Interesting, yeah. Isn't it? I can relate to that. Although, you know, he said, I've only got 30 matches in my legs for the year, so physically I'm okay, but it does... And we've heard this from other players, haven't we? Goffin and people like that, that it's a different kind of test for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had the tiniest taste of it this week, and although, you know, I'm extremely risk averse when it comes to COVID, and even more so have been in the past couple of weeks, knowing that I've got this coming up, and obviously wanting to be able to work this week and needing to return a negative test in order to do so. But I'm also aware that there is a small margin for error in the testing system, so no matter how cautious you are, there is a certain amount that's out of your control, and I felt major anxiety waiting for my test results to come back. And they're having that every 4 days, and having just as much, if not more, riding on every test result. Certainly more, you know, if it's a test sort of once you're already deep into a tournament. So, and then also you've got the consequences of everyone in your team and possibly people beyond that being affected in a massive chain reaction of self-isolation, etc. I was aware of all of that before, but getting a tiny taster of that feeling, I can understand it all. And I'm into the phrase bubble fatigue. I think he's onto something there. I did just finally on Tsitsipas. I did, as when you were saying about the fact that this was these two's first meeting since they played in the final here last year, and the fact that it's so different this time around, being, you know, jarring for both players, but obviously making it all particularly hit home for Tsitsipas. I also think, taking the pandemic-related circumstances out of it, I think today will have been jarring, kind of in tennis terms, for Tsitsipas as well. You know, take him back a year in that match. Neither of them were Grand Slam champions. They were both, okay, team had made finals. He was, you know, a step down the road. But I doubt Tsitsipas saw it that way. Tsitsipas probably saw himself and sees himself in a similar kind of bracket. He won that match that day, and let's be honest, he would have been expecting more of his year than he has achieved this year. And I can imagine, you know, he's looking down the other side of the net and thinking, I beat you in that match on this court a year ago, and you've gone on to win a Grand Slam and reach a final. I've not done any of those things, and I've lost to you today. I can imagine it feels, especially as we know he likes to disappear down a rabbit hole of despair. I can imagine how it may feel like he's gone backwards a bit. Now, that's not necessarily the case in reality, because Dominic Thiem has gone forwards. But I can see this one being a bit tough to take for Tsitsipas. I potentially worry about his mental powers of recovery for the remaining matches.
I do feel like we've talked about it in the past after that French Open loss, and obviously the most recent one, the US Open, losing to Chorich when he had it won, and he completely blew it. he does overdo it in his own mind as to the significance of a single loss. We've seen that. We've got the tangible evidence of it. I don't think he's an inferior player, but I don't think he's any better really than he was a year ago. Where his team clearly is, and there's a champion's mentality about team now. He gets the job done in some of these matches. He can occasionally throw in a real stinker, the way that Nadal would never do. But at the same time, these close matches, you believe in team, don't you? You'd be surprised if he lets himself down in them.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The most jarring moment of comparison atmosphere-wise to me was the joyous moment that your channel, Prime Video, Catherine, decided to play the Federer-Nadal match of 2010 between the sessions. And it was wonderful. And I loved every minute of it. And I went round to visit my mother, who'd been watching your coverage all afternoon. And the first thing she said to me was, oh, Catherine's teeth are okay then. But while she was...
Hello, Mrs. Law.
Yeah, so I'd interrupted her because she was absolutely loving every minute of watching this replay. She'd enjoyed the matches in the afternoon, but she was loving this match between Federer and Nadal that was going the distance from 10 years ago, and a raucous, packed crowd going wild. And you realise then, you just get that before and after feeling of oh no, we don't have that anymore. We'll have it again, I'm sure, but it does hurt to watch that and then see shortly after that Rublev and Nadal and obviously the doubles players as well, but coming out onto the court and again, and you just get reminded, oh crikey, it is so different.
I would buckle up, David, because we're going big on the archive this
great
week.
Well,
there is some 90s tennis coming your way.
I do like to. Oh, you. Oh, yes. Now we're talking. Excellent.
It may or may not feature Pete Sampras.
Oh, right. Well, I better just prepare myself, move everything in my calendar for the week.
Yeah, screw the live tennis.
Yeah.
Let's live in the 90s.
Most people are planning their days around, you know, the singles matches at 2 and 8. David's planning it around the replay in the middle.
Yeah. Somewhere around 5 p.m. is where I'm going to be enjoying my best time. So, that happened between the sessions. We then had Andre Rublev come out against Rafael Nadal, and it was the only duffer of the night, of the whole day, wasn't it, in terms of competitive matches. We'll mention the doubles in a few moments, and both of those two matches were competitive. There was a three-setter here with Thiem and Tsitsipas, but Rublev, I thought, see whether you think this is unfair, I thought it was a pretty immature performance, and he was made to look really junior-like against Nadal. I mean, I know he's playing one of the ultimate challenges, and he's playing his first ever match at the O2, first ever match in a finals, tour finals. But I think he will come off that court, Matt, feeling pretty disappointed with his own performance.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would draw a little parallel with what Catherine was saying there about, you know, having that rematch against Thiem a year later and that being a little bit dispiriting. You could almost say the same about Rublev having a rematch now with Nadal, who he played in that US Open quarterfinal 3 years ago. And the first thing to say is Rublev is a much better player now than he was then, for sure. He's improved, he's established himself, he's got the results to show that. But again, he's come up against Nadal on probably Nadal's weakest surface, and he's not got close to him, just like he didn't get close to him 3 years ago. And I think so many players have had that problem. You know, they've thought, okay, 3 years' time, Nadal, Djokovic, I'll be able to beat them. They'll be gone by then, perhaps. But no, it's kind of a testament to Nadal as well, the way he's been able to sustain his level and maybe even improve in these last few years. But I just think for Rublev, he probably thought 3 years on he would be a lot closer to Nadal than he actually was today. I can imagine that hurting and being tough to take. I must say, I mainly viewed the match through a kind of Nadal lens and a Nadal prism, if you like. Just, you know, having been to his press conference on Zoom before the tournament, I always find it really difficult to gauge with Nadal how he is feeling, because he'll never say, I'm playing well or I'm feeling good. He'll say something like, I'm working in the right way, or, you know, he gives you these slightly vague phrases, which obviously to him is, it means a lot and is his process, but it's just quite difficult to gauge where his confidence is at sometimes. And then I heard you, Catherine, saying that you'd seen him practicing and he was looking really ravenous and hungry, and he came out a little bit nervous, I thought, for a few games, but as soon as he got the break in that first set, he relaxed, and I was so impressed with Nadal's level. I thought he was playing well and also playing the right way. All the stuff he was trying in Paris, stepping in on the return, which just wasn't working today against Rublev, who's got quite a predictable serve, I think. He was just all over that second serve and so aggressive, hitting his forehand well, and all the markers, all the signs that you look for with Nadal's game were all there. And I think that's a really confidence-boosting performance, but obviously with the caveat that Rublev didn't bring his best and didn't perform as we hoped he might. But from a Nadal point of view, I think that was just really encouraging. First time he's won his opening match here for quite a few years, I think.
It was an enormous golfing class, wasn't it? I mean, I know we've been kind of talking about the negatives for Tsitsipas today, but I was sort of mentally comparing Rublev and Tsitsipas, and this is probably going to sound a bit harsh on Rublev. I really like him, and what he does well, I love to watch him do it well. I love that fast, live arm that he's got. That still really excites me, but okay, Tsitsipas has weaknesses in his game, absolutely, and things that he can work on, but he is working on them all. He doesn't want there to be any blank spots in his game, Tsitsipas. If his coach or anybody else told him, you can't do that, he wouldn't shrug and say, okay, well, that's just not going to be part of my game. He'd say, okay, well, let's see if I can work on that. You know, he builds the serve and volley in when he can, and he's you know, building variety in on the backhand, and he's trying to improve his footwork on the serve. But Rublev doesn't quite seem to have that mentality. He is very much in the, this is how I play. When it's good, it's very good, but I don't see much sign of him trying to develop plans B, C and D. It is still extremely early for him. I just want to see sort of the hints that he's trying B, C and D and sort of thinking about the need for B, C and D. And it worries me a little bit.
He's capable. You know, I mean, it would probably take to talk to a really top coach or somebody to work out whether there is, because I look at him as a fantastic plan A player if you're unable to cope with his broadside of hitting, you're going to lose if he's remotely on. But we've seen Tsitsipas, and we actually saw it in the match between the two of them at the French Open, that Tsitsipas managed to change his game in order to beat Rublev that day, because he was on the back foot for a while. And I question whether Rublev has the dexterity in his hands to be able to do different things other than what he does. I may be wrong, but I really wondered about that.
And that was kind of exposed against Nadal, who does have that ability. He was as good as Nadal's plan A is. He's got B, C, and D. And even when he's playing well, he deploys some variety. And he was using his slice backhand today a reasonable amount. And yeah, it does expose Rublev as a little bit limited, I think, when he comes up against these top players. But yeah, it's very interesting. Does he have that capacity? I think this year has been such a big year for him in terms of building the blocks that he needs to be a top 10 player. And I think next year will be more of an opportunity for us to find out whether he does have that within him. I think for now he's kind of doing everything he needs to, but if he's still in this position next year, I would be more concerned, I suppose.
He plays every tournament with his foot to the floor, like Nadal does. It's just that when Nadal does it, it's almost as though he's in a different vehicle once he gets to the Grand Slams. And when he puts his foot to the floor at the Slams, more happens. Whereas I kind of feel as though Rublev is just in his whatever car he's got, and that's the only one he's got. And he just keeps, pounding
it. What kind of car would Rublev drive?
What kind of car would he be, I wonder, as well? I think there's an interesting one. Which car is each player?
I think like a Mazda.
Yeah. Quite nippy, powerful for its size, but never going to win any Grand Prix.
Oh, God, that's brutal.
We shall see. Let us know what you think at Tennis Podcast. Which cars are the eight players here at the ATP Finals? So Nadal won through his match. In the doubles that preceded both of the singles, both of them were corkers. There was Wesley Kuhlhoff and Nicholas Mektic beating Kevin Kravets and Andreas Mies 6-7, 7-6, 10-7. And then Joe Salisbury, who has only been out of isolation for a couple of days because he was a close contact, I think, to his coach. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, Rob Morgan.
Right. Tested positive. And Rajiv Ram. They defeated Lucas Kubot and Marcelo Melo 10-5 in the third in that one. So, so there were really good matches today, weren't there, the doubles?
Yeah, some really good storylines in the doubles, all of which I know about courtesy of Matt's incredible notes. I mean, there's just tons of them. That Joe Salisbury isolation story is pretty incredible. You know, the two weeks leading up to one of the biggest weeks of their careers, and they couldn't practice together. Kevin Kravets, the German, one half of the German partnership, the two-time French Open champions, he was working in a little supermarket during lockdown in Munich, stacking shelves and disinfecting shopping trolleys. Wesley Kuhlhoff making his debut at the ATP Finals, aged 31 today, and winning. There's so many great stories.
Do we know if Kravets was doing that job in the supermarket because he needed the money or because he just wanted to do a good thing?
My understanding of it was that he wanted to help out and was kind of in a position to be able to help out.
Well, that's fantastic, isn't it? Mm. What a lovely gesture. It's really something. I was reading about Michael Venus, who's playing in the doubles tomorrow, and he's from New Zealand. And he said, I don't think I can get back to New Zealand until mid-December, if I'm lucky. You know, they just won't let him back in the country.
Yeah,
it's tough,
there's serious stuff going on behind the scenes with a lot of these guys, and I think particularly with the doubles players, because you know no special allowances are being made for them. I don't think, you know, even in New Zealand, I don't I don't know how big a name Michael Venus is. You know, I don't think ambassadors are on the phone trying to create waivers to regulations for people like him. You know, I think it's pretty serious stuff, even for the top doubles players, you know. Mm. And some of the reactions on court, you know, I keep an eye on the doubles and I watch bits here and there and it gets interesting, but mostly I'm sort of speaking to the gallery and making notes and preparing and stuff. But my attention kept being drawn to the court behind me by the volume of some of the reactions from the players. You know, it was really demonstrative stuff out there. And of course, it's more alarming because it's sort of echoing around this empty, cavernous stadium. But goodness me, it felt high stakes, the doubles today. And I think it really is high stakes. You know, this prize money purse is a huge deal for these doubles players. You know, prize money is getting cut across the board. And a lot of the time, even for top doubles players, it's going to be breaking even, I think, in the near future. So yeah, it's high stakes stuff.
Mm. And there's also the storyline that all of them can finish the year as the world number one doubles team, because there's so few points separating the eight teams that I think technically, I'm sure there's lots of permutations and complicated maths, but I think technically everyone has gone into this event with a shot at finishing the year on top. So that's just another layer of intrigue to all of these matches.
Yeah, no, it's really something, isn't it? So yeah, we'll keep an eye on the doubles all the week through as well, because we're daily with you here on the Tennis Podcast each night from the O2 Arena, or at least Catherine's in the O2 Arena. Matt and I are currently in our respective rooms. I'm drinking beer. It's lovely.
I'm drinking beer. Before you sign off, would you like me to... I've just realised I've still got my false lashes on. Oh. I know how you like to watch me. Both of you watch mesmerised as I peel them off.
I'm still trying to recover from the last time, but go on then. Oh, crikey. There it goes. That is gross, isn't it?
try wearing them all day. Look at the difference between my two eyes. Yeah. Crikey.
It's like something out of Mission Impossible.
I found out something about hair as well on our Instagram story as well, if you want to go and follow us on there, because Catherine was blow-drying a piece of hair.
Hey, do you want to hear one last story from day one?
Yes,
please. It's not really a story. Ask me how many Wagamamas I had today.
How many Wagamamas did you have today?
I had two, David.
It's a two Wagamama first day for
and
Catherine
Whittaker. I can't promise that will be a one-off.
I'd be quite disappointed if it was now.
Is there subtext here about the overall catering quality?
Apparently, the regular caterers have been struck down with COVID.
Right.
So there are extenuating circumstances. I have to say, I haven't tried the catering provided because I've been warned off it.
Right. Did you have the same thing in both your Wagamamas, or was it?
I didn't. I branched out. First time, David, I had a chicken noodle soup, basically, and some gyoza. And the second time, I had a pad thai with some bang bang cauliflower.
Well, there we go. There's your Wagamama's update on day one. We'll bring you more of that tomorrow. We've got a couple more tennis results to bring you as well. We had a title victory in Sofia for Jannik Sinner, beating Vasek Pospisil in a final set tiebreak. That's a cracking win, Matt, for Jannik Sinner, who a year ago had just won the Next Gen finals. That was the moment that I first thought, oh, right, I understand why people are getting a bit excited about this lad. And he's come on leaps and bounds, hasn't he?
Yeah, he really has. It kind of made me wonder whether, you know, next year he might actually be at the ATP finals. He's made these headlines a week before them, 2 years in a row. First ATP finals in Italy. I'm sure they're getting excited and hoping that he will be there. It's not it's not out of the question. He is improving at that kind of rate.
Similar trajectory to Tsitsipas, who'd done it the year before, hadn't he?
I would say so. And yeah, just I watched the tiebreak against Pospisil, and Sinner was the one who went out and grabbed it and, you know, really started dictating the play. And I love watching his backhand, the way he rolls his wrist over it, and he can hit it either way. It's such an exciting shot, and he's got that nimble, flexible movement as well, kind of on the stretch. Yeah, he really does look the real deal, and I'm very excited to watch him next season.
Mm. Then Irina Sabalenka won the title in Linz, beat her doubles partner Elise Mertens in the final. So Sabalenka's kind of winning everything except doing well at the slams, isn't she? So we're just waiting for that breakthrough, really.
She's having a great run at precisely the wrong time again.
Yes. I mean, yes. That match just confirmed everything we know about both players, I think. Sabalenka, at her best, can win a tournament, but she needs to do it in other places. And Mertens puts these incredibly good, consistent runs together. But when she comes up against a top 10 or top 15 player, that's kind of where she struggles. There was a nice moment at the end. Obviously, you mentioned their doubles partners. They had the trophy ceremony, and they were obviously kind of socially distanced from each other, but they did their synchronized jump that they do when they win a doubles trophy together. They did it even though that they've just been opponents. They kind of still did their signature move, if you like. So I thought that was quite nice.
Oh,
that's lovely. Very nice. Bit of news as well in the Herald Sun in Australia, reporting via an interview with Craig Tiley, the tournament director of the Australian Open, that the entire Australian tennis season in January, and maybe even February, will take place in Victoria, which is the home of the Australian Open, of course. And I do think that that's, on balance, sounds a sensible way to get through this year. How exactly they're going to organise that, if you consider that they're supposed to be having the ATP Cup and all the many tournaments that they have that are normally in places like Sydney and Adelaide. But the plan, as we kind of alluded to it the other day, didn't we, with Melbourne 1, Melbourne 4, Melbourne 8, is it's going to happen, folks. So get your numbering systems ready. Matt, have we got any shout-outs?
We do, yes. Shout outs to Andrew Talbot.
Hey, Andrew, thank you very much for your support.
Hello, Andrew.
To Drew Moria.
Drew. Top man, Drew.
And to Ishmael Betancourt.
What a name that is.
That's a belter. Good on you, Ishmael.
Say that again, Matt.
Ishmael Betancourt.
Wow.
I want that name. That's a better name than David Law. Any day. It's brilliant.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Don't agree.
Ishmael, have you considered sort of taking up a profession that might get your name on posters somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, that should be it. You should be in the theatre, shouldn't you, with a name like that?
Mm.
Maybe it's
a stage name.
Yeah, probably. Perhaps
it was a name specifically to be read out on the tennis podcast.
Yeah.
A decoy name.
Mm. Mm.
And you will be able to get your name read out on the tennis podcast. A shout out next year, if you haven't already this year, because, basically it'll be one of the categories that we have as part of our crowdfunding campaign, which begins on December the 1st when our Kickstarter begins, and we try to make sure we can do 130-odd shows and more. Always more, Catherine, is my motto. So December the 1st it'll start, and thank you for listening to this first daily edition of the show from the O2 Arena. Catherine's going to go and have beer number 3 and Wagamama's number 4.
I'm only on 2.
Oh, so we're on to 3 next. Right, cool. Matt, good night. Thank you for your company. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, David.
Who put me in charge?
I think you're supposed to say likewise.
Yes, of course.
he's like Catherine. Do you know how long he's had to put up with me today? Because he's not had you to talk to as well. Because you've been on TV. He's had to message me all day instead, receive them.
Hang on, have you been doing messaging outside of the group?
One or two, yeah,
a few.
We didn't want to distract
Hang
you.
Hang on, can you sign off and we can talk about this off air?
Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. It's only day one. See you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.